Here for argument in the case of Specialty Restaurants versus Nelson. The petitioner may proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Kristen Caruso. My bar number is 34547. And at council table with me is my colleague Nancy Fitzgerald. Her bar number is 41362. We represent the respondents in the underlying workers' compensation matter, Specialty Restaurants Corporation and Colorado Insurance Guarantee Association, care of Western Guarantee Fund Services. From time to time throughout my discussion, I will refer to this party as SEGA. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so during the next 25 minutes, I'll give a brief history of the case and specifically address the important issues here on review. I intend to explain why the application of the 2007 amendment to the lump sum statute, as ordered by the Court of Appeals, produces an absurd result, because every statutory amendment would trigger every claimant with pending workers' compensation claims to apply for new lump sum payments. The two issues we're here to discuss today is, one, whether the Court of Appeals erred in failing to apply the presumption that a prior judicial interpretation of the statutory provision is adopted by the legislature when the same statutory provision is amended, and two, whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding that the 2007 amendment to CRS Section 843-4062, which increased the aggregate lump sum payment available to a workers' compensation claimant, applied to a claimant whose injury occurred prior to the date of the amendment. As a brief history, Ms. Nelson was injured at work on June 1st, 1990. She became permanently and totally disabled on October 21st, 2002. The final admission of liability was filed by SEGA, admitting to permanent total disability benefits on February 5th, 2007. On June 1st, 1990, the lump sum provision in the Colorado Workers' Compensation Act provided for a maximum statutory lump sum award of $26,292. In February of 2007, Ms. Nelson applied for and was awarded that lump sum amount. In May of 2007, our legislature amended the lump sum provision and increased the maximum award from $37,560 to an aggregate of $60,000.
Can I just ask a couple of questions about that? The award, how much was the award to the employee? The original award. She was found permanently, totally disabled, correct?
Correct.
And how much was she awarded?
The amount of her permanent total disability benefits, they're paid to her biweekly for the rest of her life.
And they were in what amount?
I don't have that number available with me right now, but I would venture to guess that they were a couple of hundred dollars biweekly.
Okay. And then how does it work when the employee decides to take a lump sum? Is that deducted from their total award so that if she eventually lived long enough, she would then resume getting her bi-monthly payments again? Or how does that work?
Chief Justice, the way that it works, it can be confusing. The employee applies for their lump sum award. In this case, she applied for it and she received $26,292. That amount comes off of her total permanent total disability awards, so to speak. We really don't know what that amount is because we aren't sure how long she'll live.
Right.
But ultimately, the $26,292 would be, for lack of a better description, reduced from her biweekly payments in increments.
And so how did they figure out when she might be, if she lives longer than that, than the expected time, how would they figure out when her benefits start to pick up again?
She would still get her bi-weekly benefits. Let's say it's $200 hypothetically. Uh-huh. She gets $200 every other week,
right,
for the rest of her life. That doesn't stop.
Okay.
What happens is it's reduced by a small amount to account for the $26,292 that's paid in lump sum. The argument that's been presented to this court is that SIGA, and in other cases, other insurance companies, get to benefit from having to pay this lump sum by being able to apply a 4% reduction to her ongoing bi-weekly benefits because they're paying a lump sum now. The reality is that 4% doesn't mean a whole lot.
Isn't that a discount for present value?
It's a discount for present value. The problem is that once an injured worker applies for and receives their lump sum amount, SIGA never gets that money back. So tomorrow, if Ms. Nelson were to wake up and be cured and go back to work, she wouldn't be entitled to that permanent total disability payment that she's getting now every other week, and SIGA will never be able to recover the lump sum payment that they paid. I'm not a mathematician and I'm not an economist. I know, Justice Malarkey, that you are, and we are dealing with time value of money issues. And the time value of money is worth much more than the present value discount of the 4%. But our legislature has decided that claimants should be entitled to some lump sum payment. And the reason when we listen to some of the tapes by our senators is because claimants have needs that they need to take care of now. They need a reservation on their house. They need an unrelated medical surgery. They need some cash. And so it's because of that that incrementally over time, the lump sum payment has increased.
Ms. Grunzel, would it be fair to say that what you're saying is theoretically, the statute, you know, makes it not matter whether they take lump sum or not by accounting for time value. But as a practical matter, it does matter, and it's much more costly to SIGA.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. It does matter. It is much more costly to SIGA. SIGA has to come up with the money now. And the rights and liabilities of the parties are exchanged at the time, at the date of the injury. And at the date of, for instance, Ms. Nelson's injury on June 1st, 1990, the insurance company, or SIGA, had some type of way to estimate what its liabilities are in the case. And by passing an amendment to the lump sum statute that was passed and then applied by the Court of Appeals as being prospective in nature, but applying to all open claims, SIGA now has to come up with this money that it didn't anticipate having to have available to this particular claimant and other claimants in her circumstances.
So, just if you could help me out, I'm not sure I understand exactly what the employee wants here. So the amount has gone up, I understand that. Does she not want the difference between whatever her lump sum payment was and that amount?
Yes, Your Honor. On October 28, 2007, Ms. Nelson requested an additional lump sum in the amount of $33,708.
That's just the difference between
those
difference, two amounts?
Yes, it brings her to the aggregate total of $60,000.
Okay. And then I assume that she would concede, SIGA could decrease her bimonthly payments.
I don't think that would be a dispute, right? I think that the dispute is that the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation issued an order without taking any evidence and without having a hearing that respondents pay the additional $33,708, which led us here today. The reason why SIGA objected to paying this additional amount was because it was much more costly to pay that $33,708 in lump sum now rather than paying it over the time of this person's life. And what happened was, and the first reason why we're here today is the Court of Appeals did not consider or apply the presumption that a prior judicial interpretation of a statutory provision is adopted by the legislature when the same statutory provision is amended.
I don't see why that's applicable here. Would you explain that? I mean, what decision is it that you're trying to uphold?
After the director issued an order requiring the SIGA to pay the $33,708, SIGA appealed, and they went to the Industrial Claims Appeals Office, which I'll refer to as the panel. And the panel relied on the 8000 West case, which was heavily briefed by both parties. And the panel had issued an order that essentially held that under 8000 West, the change, the increase in a lump sum amount is a substantive change in an amendment. And therefore, it cannot be applied retroactively. And Ms. Nelson wouldn't be entitled to the $33,708. Ms. Nelson appealed, brought it to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals essentially held, well, we think that the amendment to the lump sum statute is procedural. It doesn't change the amount that SIGA has to pay to claimant for permanent total disability benefits. It only changes the timeline.
Well, is that true or not?
I disagree with that. I think.
Why?
Because I think that the amount does change. I think that when we consider the time value of money, we consider the fact that now SIGA has to find that cash, and we consider that there are circumstances that may occur that would result in Ms. Nelson not being entitled to that money, that the Court of Appeals...
But aren't you really saying, as a practical matter, it matters? But yeah, I thought I heard you agree earlier that in theory, the thing is set up so that it doesn't matter because time value is accounted for.
Present value is accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are other effects on this money that's not accounted for. She goes back to work if she dies tomorrow.
Those things, of course, can't be accounted for because they're not predictable, right?
We assume that the 4% is accurate, but we all know that with the economics, 4%, really, nobody can rely on a 4% present value that was established to correctly and accurately account for the value of that money. We use the example in our brief of a debtor and a creditor. You have a mortgage, and you pay your mortgage every month. And your mortgage company says, well, we understand that you're paying every month, but now we want $50,000 from you now. That $50,000 to you is worth something. You still have the mortgage on your house. You still have to pay the mortgage company. But by accelerating the payments that you have to make, that matters, and it's damaging.
Well, you would concede that the legislature could do this, right? That are you arguing that it's unconstitutional for them to do this, or that the legislature didn't intend to do this? After all, this new figure is what the insurance companies are going to have to pay henceforward after the bill. You don't argue that, right? So they have authority to do that, right?
I think that it is unconstitutional for the legislature to make a substantive change to a statute and apply it retrospectively.
Is that what happens with this?
I think that's the way that it operates, yes. The language has been, semantics has been thrown all over the place. We've used the words retroactive, retrospective, prospective. What's happening is the legislature made substantive change to the lump sum statute by changing the aggregate amount payable to claimants. And the application of that applies to all open claims, regardless of what the date of injury is. So I do think that it is retroactive, regardless of what the Supreme Court called it. They called it prospective. And I do think that is unconstitutional.
Well, were these arguments...
The Court of Appeals...
Were these arguments raised in the legislature? Certainly the insurance companies track these bills like hawks now. So what would the legislative history tell us about the legislature's intent?
What's interesting is that if we listen to the introduction of the bill, if we listen to those recordings, Senator Goff explained that the reason for the change in the amount of lump sum is because it hadn't been increased in about 20 years and that the reality of the current economics warranted the change.
Why wouldn't that rationale apply to, you know, someone who was injured 15 years ago?
The current economics 15 years ago were
different.
They were,
of course,
15 years ago, right? So I think that if someone's injured now and the effective date of the amendment is now, then that person would be entitled to a lump sum payment, the $60,000 now. But what's interesting is if we look at the amendments to the statute, 8000 West was decided February 19, 1976. 8000 West held that the amendment to the lump sum statute by increasing the amount is a substantive change to the statute. In 1991, the legislature amended the lump sum statute and specifically stated this act shall take effect July 1, 1991 and shall apply to injuries occurring on or after said date. The legislature incorporated what the Court of Appeals held in 8000 West.
Well, but what did they do on this legislation? Did they include that phrase or didn't they?
They didn't include any effective date. All that we know is that it was approved on May 20th, 2007. And under the City of Colorado Springs versus Powell, legislation should only be applied retroactively if the legislature clearly so intended. So all that we can assume is that it was sloppy legislation.
Counsel, could I just ask you a quick question? What, when you you are making the assumption that it applies to all open cases?
Yes.
And first of all, could you tell me what you mean by open, and second, why you're making that assumption?
All open cases would be any case that is technically considered open by the Department of Workers' Compensation, to which claimants would be entitled some type of lump sum payment. We're talking permanent total disability cases. So regardless of what the date of injury was, if the claim is...
If it's a permanent injury, then you say it's open. But I guess I'm just working on that assumption.
The way that it works is generally if it's an admitted claim, mm-hmm. and the injured worker is receiving some benefit from the insurance company, the injured worker has a couple of different ways to request a lump sum. They can request a $10,000 lump sum payment that they get automatically once they reach maximum medical improvement and permanency. In this case, I think we're really dealing with permanent total disability cases. And so if an injured worker has a claim that is through the Division of Workers' Compensation that is being paid out by an insurance company, I would consider that an open case for which they can come back and request an aggregate of
So is the extent of your assumption then that any person who was in a position to take the 37.5, is that what the number was, prior to the statutory change?
It was, but in this case, it didn't apply to Ms. Nelson because in 1991, the statute specifically said it should only apply to dates of injury on or after the effective date of July 1st, 1991. So for Ms. Nelson, we're talking about the 22-292.
Okay, so she was hurt in 1990. New statute And at that point, she was entitled to 22,292, right?
Correct.
Then there's a whole nother group of people who were hurt after 91. They're entitled to the 37.5 or whatever that number is.
Correct.
And we're sure that for that category of people, that's all they're entitled to. That's your assumption until we get to the 07 statute, which is the 60,000.
Yes.
So is the universe of people who would now be entitled to go up to 60,000 everybody who came before? Is that your position?
I think that's the Court of Appeals' position. We disagree with that.
Okay, and is part of your concern the explicit date of effectiveness in the 91 legislation?
I think that's some of our position. The legislature was presumed to have known the 8,000 West case.
And they said injuries on or after 91.
Correct. 8,000 West said it's a substantive, the change in the lump sum payment is a substantive change, which resulted in this 91 language that said shall apply to injuries occurring on or after said date. The legislature adopted what was the language in 8,000 West.
Well, I go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, I guess I'm missing something. So assuming that we have this new legislative action from 91 that says only people going forward, how do we get back to 90, the 22,297 being all the way up to 60?
What the Court of Appeals had decided was that the amendment is procedural and prospective. So therefore, the Court of Appeals completely disregarded its prior decision in 8,000 West. Contrary to the way that the panel had analyzed the statutory construction, and contrary to the position, of course, that SIGA takes. In fact, if we look at all of the amendments, in 1975, the lump sum statute stated, this act shall take effect September 1st, 1975. In 1987.
Did it say for injuries on or after? Because that's, we really want this on or after, injuries on or after language to be positive, what we're talking about, don't
right.
we?
Right, that didn't happen until 1991,
okay.
Which was after the 8,000 West case.
And it only was in 1991, just the one time?
Just the one time.
And then it wasn't amended again between 91 and 07?
Correct.
And we didn't have that on or after language in 07, just effective date, period.
There was not even effective date, period. That wasn't even in there.
Well, doesn't that indicate that the legislature intended a change from the pre-existing legislation?
I don't think so. I think it indicates that the legislature omitted a sentence.
Well,
I think that under
we're supposed to take their language as they say it, right?
Well,
and presume that they meant what they said. So you want us to basically add on the language that they had there in the prior statute because somehow they forgot.
I agree that we're supposed to take what they say and apply meaning to what they say. But what we have to look at here is what they didn't say. And in City of Colorado Springs versus Powell, there has to be express legislative intent to make a change like that. And there wasn't. The failure of the legislature to express intent to make such a change requires us to consider this just as an omission, not as a removal.
Could you comment on the director's, what kind of emphasis we should give on the director's order as opposed to the ICAO panel? Because they seem to say different things.
Right, under Berg versus ICAO, which was a Court of Appeals case, the court held that we give due deference to the interpretation of the statute adopted by the panel as the agency charged with its enforcement. That rationale has been followed consistently, that we give deference to the panel. And so I think that we follow that, that we follow the panel's guidance. I think that the Court of Appeals got it wrong when they mislabeled the amendment as procedural and prospective in nature. We have argued consistently that the amendment is substantive and retroactive. That the amendment is substantive and retroactive and therefore should not be permitted. What's interesting is that on January 26, 2010, the Court of Appeals issued an order in Navarrete, and both parties have submitted that case to this court. And it's clear in the Navarrete case that the Court of Appeals is confused. And the reason why I say that is because the court held that the same amendment was procedural in nature and retroactive in its application. But in our case, the Court of Appeals held that the amendment was procedural in nature and prospective in its operation. So here we have the Court of Appeals who's given us two different theories of how they're dealing with this issue.
You still have lost me here. Didn't you mean to say it's substantive and prospective?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I did. I misspoke. It's substantive and prospective.
So you're not arguing that they took an unconstitutional act. You're not saying they intended to make it retroactive.
The legislature did not intend to make it retroactive.
Okay.
I think that the Court of Appeals, by stating that the transaction date for the procedural operation is the date of the application for lump sum, was the date that Ms. Nelson applied for her difference in the aggregate lump sum, was incorrect. The transaction date is the date of the injury. That's the date that the rights and liabilities of the parties were exchanged, and that's the date that we have to look back to for the trigger of when all of this applies. And if there are no more additional questions, I would like to reserve my remaining time.
Yeah, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I believe the case of 8000 West isn't worthy of all the attention it's received in this case.
It was, excuse me, yes. I hate to interrupt you, but would you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry.
Because we record these.
Stephanie Stevenson. Do you need my bar number?
No. And you're here for the claimant.
I represent the claimant, Stephanie.
Please go ahead.
I believe that 8000 West is not worthy of all the attention it's received in this case. It was actually a very simple decision requiring not much judicial interpretation or analysis because its holding was controlled by the plain language that said this act shall take effect on 7-1 of 71. In finding the lump sum amendment substantive, the 8000 West court engaged in no real analysis to support its position other than to suggest an effect it would have on insurers. And for that position, it relied on vague language about chaos ensuing if it applied to earlier dates of injury. But there was no mention of any evidence at all to support that position. Just as in this case, counsel's arguments that this case would create difficult for SIGA is not part of the record here. Respondents could have requested an evidentiary hearing in front of the director. They did not do so. The director's order came out on respondents' motion requesting it without hearing. 8000 West doesn't mention any guidance at all of the interpretation from the director, and the director is the official charged with the administration of the agency. Without the benefit of the director's analysis, that case may well have turned out differently. We'll never know. But as a result, it was appropriate for the director in Nelson to consider this case as one of first impression. And to the extent that respondents argue that the difference of opinion between the director and the panel should be weighed toward the panel, I would respectfully disagree. The director is the official charged with the administration of the agency. He has the authority to hire, fire, make rules, issue advisories, and run the day-to-day operation.
May I interrupt one second? With regard to construing the applicable date, the effective date of the
yes.
statute, do you think we should be showing any deference to either the director or the ICAO?
With respect to the enactment date?
Yes. Is that a matter of law that we should determine for ourselves?
I think that is a matter that this court should determine. The only change to this amendment which was clear was 91, when it said it applies to dates on or after this, injuries on or after this day. The prior amendments and the subsequent amendments did not have that. In this particular case, there was no enactment language at all. It was a simple approval process.
And so we're faced with a, would you call that an ambiguity? We're faced anyway with construing, using rules, aids to construction in order to decide when the legislature intended this statute to be effective. Is that right? And to whom it should apply?
Well, I do think that the plain language does aid in that construction, certainly.
And with regard to that kind of an exercise, I guess what I'm asking is, we seem to be spending some time here arguing about whether we should defer to the director or the ICO, but should we defer to either one?
Well, I would argue that you should defer to the director.
And why would that be?
Because he is the official charged with the administration of the agency.
And does he construe the law better than we do?
I would not dare say. But certainly it is his obligation and his authority to look at the passage of a law and to make an
interpretation. I guess one of the things I'm sort of driving at, is there anything about you talked about him being the person in this position, but what I'm sort of driving at, is there anything that has to do with expertise with regard to management that would apply here, or are we purely applying rules of construction and aids to construction in order to decide what the intent of the legislature was?
Well, I would argue again that the director does have the expertise in making those determinations based upon his authority within the agency.
And is that expertise with regard to determining how much money the insurance company will ultimately have to pay, or what likelihoods are, or how the system works? What is there about it that gives him expertise that we should be concerned about?
Well, the statute gives him expertise. The statute gives him expertise. The case law says that deference is given to the director of the agency.
Justice Rice's series of questions now. What is the universe of who is covered under your and the Court of Appeals interpretation?
I see the universe a little bit differently than counsel before. I think the universe of people who are covered by this change are those with those people who are owed benefits currently, who apply for the lump sum.
Okay, so that means anybody with a permanent disability who's receiving these biweekly payments.
Yes.
No matter when their injury occurred.
Yes, and I believe that covers permanent partial and permanent total disability.
Right. Okay.
But before you get too far away from the 8,000, and you talked about substantive there, and I may be throwing you off your order of things here, but you indicated that probably was not very important, and we're all paying too much attention to that, especially because of the lack of concern they had, or really justification for calling this substantive. I wanted to ask you, with regard to your argument that it is a procedural matter, how important is it to argument about the scope of application that we find this is procedural? Is it essential that we find it be procedural for your position to be victorious here?
I believe that it is. And I believe it's a procedural amendment because it really only applies to the methods of distributing these funds.
But And let me just ask you right there, and we'll get right to the heart of what was concerning me. It seemed to me you make the argument it does not affect the award. It only affects the procedural way in which it's distributed.
Yes.
And that's why it's procedural rather than substantive. If it, of course, unless you disagree, and maybe you could tell me here, your opponent seems to say it may very well affect the amount of money that has to be paid, though. If that is true, does it matter whether we call that affecting the award or simply the amount of the payment? Or do you disagree that it could even affect the amount of the money that will ultimately have to be paid?
Well, I think in any particular case, the carrier may in fact pay more or less as the result of a lump sum. So if, as in counsel's example, the claimant receives a lump sum and then dies tomorrow, that person may very well have gotten more money than they would have gotten had that lump sum not been distributed. On the other hand, a claimant who remains on permanent total disability and outlives that life expectancy, that person's benefits are reduced for the life of their claim. They never go back up. And so in those instances, those claimants receive less money than they would otherwise receive. So I think it's a balancing of the interests of the parties, and that's why that 4% is in the statute, which allows the carrier essentially to get paid back over time for the lump sum disbursement. The claimant gets less in each individual payment, the carrier pays less, and that's how the interests of the parties are balanced.
I know we're probably dwelling too much on the math of it, but so this woman was hurt in 1990. 17 years later, she wants to increase her lump sum. Over the last 17 years, her payout has not been decreased in accordance with this increase in lump sum payment.
Well, she did receive...
It has been to a certain degree, but not to the $60,000.
Not to the $60,000.
All right, so there are fewer years actuarially for that $60,000. I guess, what would that be, 37 or something like that, the difference?
About 33,000.
33. There are fewer years from an actuarial point of view for that $33,000 to be made up. 17 fewer years for that to be made up, right?
Yes.
All right. So that's a substantive change, isn't it? I mean, that really affects the actuarial calculation of how this lump sum is accredited, if nothing else.
Well, it's credited over the remaining life expectancy. So it's still credited over the number of years that...
But there are 17 fewer years.
And it's reduced proportionately.
Well, I understand that, but maybe we're talking at cross purposes. I guess my point is that... You know, from an insurance perspective, you would amortize or credit this over an expected lifetime, right?
Yes.
Here, the expected lifetime is 17 years fewer than it would have been.
Had the $60,000 been available on her date of injury, but you have to understand the lump sum is not available as of a date of injury. The lump sum is not available until a date of an award.
When did she take her lump sum?
In this case, she was injured in 1990. She was awarded permanent and total disability in 2002. She received a lump sum payment sometime in 2005, I believe. Or may have been 2004. She received the first lump sum.
So you're saying that 17 years doesn't really make sense. It's really more a three-year difference.
Right. It's at whatever point you come into the system. So if you come in at age 45, you have until your life expectancy there. If you come in at age 20, you have until your life expectancy there. But that is accounted for in the calculation.
One more question. She wasn't even entitled, is your position, she wasn't even entitled to take her $22,292 lump sum until 2002?
That's correct.
12 years after her injury.
That's correct.
And why is that?
Because she was not determined to be permanently and totally disabled until that time.
All right, thank you.
I have a question in terms of the calculation of how the payments are reduced. Now, as far as the life expectancy has changed as well, I presume, because it's based on actuarian tables, and it may be a few years less, but the person survived longer, too, so numbers are really just different, right?
That, well, there is a, the life expectancy table that we currently use in the workers' comp system is actually rather old and has not been updated for quite some time. But that's the system, that's the life expectancy table that we're using.
I see. And then the calculation that's made is theoretically designed to, during the person's lifetime, the reduction pays for the lump sum amount with an adjustment for time value.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
Could I ask one more question along these lines? With regard to constitutional retrospectivity, the question of whether something would be unconstitutional by retroactively applying it, do you think something would be unconstitutional even if we couldn't say for sure that it changed the amount of money that someone would have to pay, if it changed the expectations? If a statute existed that required the payor to pay out a certain amount per week for the rest of a person's life, and the statute changed and required them to pay a larger amount up front with smaller payments so that it changed the calculation of how much they'd ultimately have to pay, even though we can't say whether how it would turn out, because that would depend on how long this individual lived, could that be unconstitutionally retrospective?
I think that it could be, but how I see this amendment, and I don't believe that really the constitutionality was properly raised before this court, but to answer your question, I believe the way that this statute could be unconstitutionally retrospective is if it required carriers to pay everyone who had requested a lump sum the additional amount. It doesn't require that. It requires a claimant to request that. First, the claimant has to be entitled to the ongoing benefits, and they have to file an application, which is the transaction that the Court of Appeals determined was the relevant transaction in whether or not how this applied. Contrary to counsel's arguments that's a retroactive application, it is not. Retroactive would be if it applied without those requirements. And that's looking at those cases like Taylor and Albright, which again look to balance the interests of the parties here with the 4% discount, and there's also a contingency for death, and
We'll focus on the individual case. You're talking about the individual application.
Yes.
So what is adjusted and looked at in this individual application that saves it from an unconstitutional just pay over more money?
The initial statute dealing with lump sums required a claimant to apply, request a lump sum. It's a fairly simple form. And then the director calculated what the present value was and issued an order. That was the 91 amendment. The 2007 amendment says you no longer need the director's approval in order to get the lump sum. You are entitled to that $60,000 as a matter of law. And so the claimant requests it. The carrier can object to it if they choose to do so. More often, of course, they complete the form and issue a check, and the application forms are filed with the division.
So I don't understand the significance of that application from a constitutional perspective. I just don't understand what you've actually said, why that makes a difference, I guess is my point.
From a constitutional perspective,
yeah.
Why it matters constitutionally,
right, whether or not. So you have to file an application.
From a constitutional perspective, I would agree there it probably does, the application probably doesn't matter in and of itself. But it is a change in the entire statute. It's not just a simple change in the amount. The statute changed as well that allows for this election. But the important aspect is the change in the substantive value, or sorry, in the lump sum value.
Well, I think Justice Hobbs asked you a question, though, that I'd like you to focus in on. What is it that prevents this statute from just saying to, you know, the petitioner, you have to pay more money now to all of these people going back for a very long time just because we changed our minds about how much you have to pay? What offsets that, if anything?
Well, it's again offset by the same provisions that have been present all along, that, that those monies are paid back. And again, there's no evidence in this case that that addition, that those additional funds cause any prejudice to the respondents in paying the additional amounts.
That's because it's projected out and there's going to be a diminution in the amount they get paid biweekly, is that right?
Yes.
So some sort of calculation has to be made, right?
Yes.
And who makes that and when?
The calculations are made by the carrier using calculators available on the division's website. The division, by the way, generally checks those calculations and affirms them.
And there are guidelines or rules of the director that that have to do with this or not?
Yes, there are.
Okay, where do we find those?
I'm sorry, I don't have the citation for the rule, but they would be found on the division's website. For one, would give us the directions for how to.
Your argument is that this person is already entitled to a lifetime award.
She's already entitled to the that amount of money anyway.
Right. So it just gets advanced.
It just gets advanced.
And offset.
She essentially pays it back, if you will, through the reduction in those biweekly benefits.
Right. And actuarially, it'll work out somehow here, because every individual's lifetime is going to be different. And how is it then, can these people ever get back into the workforce and then this these payments canceled?
If a claimant's medical condition improved, well, understand, in the case of permanent partial disability, they may very well easily go back into the workforce.
Right.
But in the case of permanent total disability, a claimant could, through medical advances or some other medical improvement, improve their condition, could improve to the point that they're capable of sustaining employment.
Okay, what do you make of the fact that they didn't put an effective date on this? That's in counterposition of the explicit effective date in the 1991 legislation.
Well, I think the legislature intended it to be. This was part of a larger procedural bill that's found in Article 43, which is the part of the statute that deals with procedures. I think the legislature intended for it to be a procedural change that applies to all dates of injury.
Assuming that the legislature only intended its 1991 amendments to apply prospectively to people who were injured after 1991?
Yes.
Why does it follow that when they made this change in 2007, they would go back before 1991 to 1990 and even earlier, given that they'd already said that they didn't want their first increase to go back?
Well, the fact that they didn't use the same language in the second in the 2007 increase, I think, is significant. They certainly could have done that had they intended the change only to apply to dates of injury after May 30th of 2007. They did not put that language in there. Obviously, they could have done so. They did so in 1991.
Now, what would be the scenario where somebody doesn't want a lump sum payment? Is that a possibility?
It certainly is, and there are times when a claimant would just prefer to receive their benefits over their lifetime. I have had a case or two where my clients have chosen to do that because they didn't want their benefit. They were concerned, perhaps, about family members getting a hold of a lump sum, and they just preferred to have that money coming in. They knew they could count on it.
So a guaranteed greater amount of income on the biweekly.
Yes.
So there is a real choice.
There is a real choice, yes.
That the application procedure
Right.
requires them to make. Consider whether or not they really want to take the lump or stay with the steady check they've got.
Yes. Other questions?
I don't recall if either party cited any statute creating, sometimes the legislature creates default rules on construction. Is there one here saying that if we don't do a date, effective date, it shall be prospective or whatever?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Checking to see if there's anything I can add.
Well, I'd be interested in your legislative history and analysis. I mean, is that in the record, by the way? Did anybody do that?
It is not. The legislative history of the changes to the statute is outlined in the amendments overall are outlined in the amicus. The actual right. testimony in the legislative history is not.
Well, I'm particularly interested in what the sponsors had to say. Is there anything that helps us one way or the other on that?
Not to my knowledge. The bill was again passed as part of a larger procedural bill. As Ms. Caruso indicated, at least one, I believe she said the sponsor indicated that it was a change in that it was an appropriate time to change to increase that amount. The other thing I think that it's important to keep in mind is that with regard to this issue of reserves, and this is kind of going back to earlier, is this idea that the insurance carrier's liability is not set in stone in a workers' compensation claim. The fee schedule, which is the method by which all medical providers are paid, changes on a regular basis. And so while a carrier may set reserves or have an expectation of a particular amount that they're going to pay in a case, that changes in other areas of the workers' compensation law as well, particularly with respect to the fee schedule. And so for respondents to suggest that their liability somehow remains static throughout the claim is just not an accurate reflection.
Well, somehow the premiums go up on all of us, don't they?
Yes.
Right? Isn't that what happens? The companies can adjust?
That's true, yes.
How's it?
The company, the premiums will adjust, but it's not, those aren't necessarily the premiums that are being paid by the company who has the loss.
Right.
So again, right. because it's that pooling of interest, it's not, it can't be compared to an individual dealing with an individual situation. I think that the most important precedent to rely on here are the Taylor and Albright cases in which statutes changed and the parties were permitted to, in Taylor, pay back monies that had been paid into PARA in exchange for that higher benefit amount. I think that's very analogous to what we're talking about here, and that is what makes this, and those cases both found those statutes to be procedural and prospective, which is what, of course, the Court of Appeals did in this particular case. Anything else? Further questions? Thank you.
Just to clarify a few issues that were raised in the most recent exchange, Justice Mularkey, there is a general saving statute. It's at CRS Section 24303. It says that the amendment of any statute or part of a statute or section or part of a section of any statute shall not have the effect to release, extinguish, alter, modify, or change in whole or in part any penalty, forfeiture, or liability, either civil or criminal, which shall have been incurred under such statute unless the amending act so expressly provides. There was the mention, I believe, by Justice Hobbs of the ability for insurance companies to increase premiums. In the case of SIGA, SIGA is not an insurance company, and it does not collect premiums. SIGA pays claims for insurance companies who have been liquidated. And the way that SIGA raises money is a 2% tax, if you will, on all other insurance companies that write workers' compensation plans or policies in the state. So SIGA does not have the ability to adjust by raising premiums. With respect to the issue of the fee schedule is greatly designed to address the cost of medical care. And at the time someone is injured, insurance companies and SIGA have an expectation of what medical expenses will be. And this is based on their histories and their experience in providing or paying medical benefits. The expectation by SIGA is made at the date of the injury, and there's no way to expect how much cash to have on hand at any time if amendments like this are permitted to be passed and reach back to dates of injury 20 years before. I think that there was discussion by Justice Coates on the substantive nature of this amendment. And as I was sitting at council table, I thought, well, I don't think any of us here would agree that Ms. Nelson's permanent total disability payments could be paid quarterly as an amendment to the change in her payment schedule rather than biweekly, because we would all agree that such a change would be substantive. It would significantly affect her. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about with respect to the application of this amendment to SIGA. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for their arguments. Case stands submitted, and the court will be in recess.